Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining me tonight on Monday, December the 22nd. We are only a few days away from Christmas. So Merry Christmas to you, a couple days early. I hope everyone has had an opportunity to sort of get their shopping done so that you can enjoy this time with your family and celebrate Christmas for the true meaning of Christmas, and that is the birth of Jesus Christ. So I want to welcome you to tonight's show and ask that if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to call in at 347-205-9620. I really like it when, you know, the listeners call in and ask the guests questions because it gives you an opportunity to ask those questions that maybe I haven't asked or things that are just burning in you that you want to get out there to our guests and have them respond to what you're asking and what you want to know. So let's move on to our guest. It's, you know, it's really refreshing in this day and time to kind of find people who are like-minded. And I know that a lot of times we watch TV or we listen to the news and we see a lot of the youth of today that are very much pointed in the liberal way. You know, we watch sometimes how people will sort of go up to the students in the college campuses and ask them questions. And it's really disappointing to see that, you know, they don't even know who the president of the United States is sometimes. They don't know who's running, who may be considering running. They don't understand politics at all, but it goes a lot further than that. They don't understand at times the Constitution. But they can tell you you know, very quickly who Miley Cyrus is. And so it's refreshing for me when I find someone who is a young conservative activist. And that is who we have on for tonight on our guest. We have Stephanie Conway. And let me just tell you a little bit about her. She was born and raised in Connecticut. And right there you would think, okay, she's got to be liberal. But no, no, she's not. She's a conservative. She brings with her a passion and drive for liberty and American restoration. Music to the conservative ears here. She has an understanding of what poor economic policies do to once prosperous states. She's now a field coordinator in North Texas with youth organization called Turning Point USA. She's part of a dynamic team of activists working to preserve liberty and restore the economic prosperity through education of the people who can make a large impact, and that is the youth of today on our campuses. Her experience in politics includes time as a local television host, an independent talk radio host, and working on the Eastern Connecticut State University campus with students as the president of the university's Conservative Libertarians Club. That's only a sampling, though, because Stephanie never settles for what opportunities are immediately available. She works tirelessly to constantly find and create her own path dotted with challenges, success, and constant improvement of her craft. Again, extremely refreshing to hear. So without further ado, as they say, let's bring Stephanie on. Stephanie Conway, welcome to the show.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, thank you. Now, I talked a little bit about your background. Tell us, if you will, what, because a lot of people out there, we don't know a lot of what the youth are doing today, the activists, the conservative activists. Tell me about Turning Point USA, and that's at turningpointusa.net. Tell me about the organization.
Well, Turning Point USA is a nonpartisan organization that goes on every campus across the country. We're in all 50 states, and what we do is instead of focusing on telling students who to elect, we talk to them about the issues. We have field coordinators who have a very unified message. We make sure that all of our activism for the semester is strategically laid out. So on every campus throughout the semester, we have field coordinators and chapters and just individual students talking about the same message of liberty and smaller government and bringing the issues and discussions about the issues to the students. Because once you have those students talking about issues rather than candidates, you can lead them in the right direction. Because a lot of young people have a hard time identifying where they really fall politically. Everything gets so skewed in the classroom and in the media, and it's very convoluted and difficult to understand. So if you can talk to them about the issues and help them see kind of the light on where they need to stand on the issues, then they vote the right way all on their own. So that's what Turning Point really does, is we try to enlighten students.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about the founder of Turning Point?
Sure. Our founder is Charlie Kirk from Illinois. He's only 21 years old now. He saw kind of this gap in activism, and that there weren't these people with clipboards on the ground on college campuses talking to students about capitalism and limited government and the free market and all the great things that that really does. And he decided that he would go to school part-time and start this organization instead. So he's still in school and kind of mobilizing a youth movement that's entirely different from anything else we've ever seen on the right on college campuses.
Wow. Now, when you tell me how you're perceived and how, if you're welcomed or not at most of the college campuses you go to, what's that like for you?
It's kind of hit or miss. It really depends on which campus we go to or what the administration does. I've had some people in the administration come up to me and shake my hand, say they're so happy I'm here, they're so glad to see this message on campus. And I've had another administrator who, from pressure that he received from other people at the school, other teachers and professors, had decided they had a fully booked schedule and they didn't have any room for me to come back onto campus. So the administration is kind of, yeah, I saw right through that one. I said, okay, thank you. And then I went to campus with a clipboard. But students are largely very receptive. They want to talk about these different things. They see our messages because we do it in a different kind of way. We use posters from House of Cards, or we use posters that had characters that they kind of could relate to that they had seen before. And so they wanted to come up and talk about what this crazy poster is that I have on the table. And they want the free buttons. But they're very receptive to having these conversations because we're asking them to tell us their opinion. And there is nothing that college students like more than telling you what they think.
And do you find that a lot of the college students that you talk to, they really are unaware of the, you know, what's going on in politics, what's going on in their government? I mean, do you find that you have to really teach these people?
Many of them have kind of a basic idea. They understand that the government is doing some weird things, that we have a very large debt, and that we pay taxes. For the most part, they're kind of disinterested because it's become so complicated that they can't immediately see how these different policy decisions relate to their everyday lives. And that's where we see the biggest problem with young people and the biggest issue with getting them to the polls is they don't understand the importance of it because they can't draw that straight line from policy A to their life. They have to stop at all these different points. So what we kind of try to do is walk them through these steps and show them exactly how these big government policies adversely affect everything that they're trying to do.
Do you find that a lot of the people that you talk to on the college campuses, are they really sold on, let's say, socialism? I've spoken to a lot of people in their, you know, early and mid-20s that seem to believe, and maybe it's just a sampling of the people that I talk to, but they seem to believe that socialism has a really good choice, that capitalism doesn't work, and that socialism is a really good choice.
You know, a lot of young students and college students do think that, but it's not that they think it from an educated standpoint. They think it because that's what they've been kind of told by their teachers, that, oh, this is so nice and sunshine and roses and everybody's equal. And so they come at it from a place of having no understanding. I've been joking that we should do a college student socialism exchange program for years now, where we should just send them over to these countries.
Good idea.
And invite them back. Do you appreciate us now? Is this better now? Because they haven't seen it. They haven't been exposed to it. We don't value history the same way that a lot of other societies or cultures do. And so our students don't get exposed to what it's really like to live under socialist-type countries. They don't want to be bothered to have to see it. They see North Korea and they think the crazy man with the nukes. They don't think, oh my gosh, what an oppressive country this is, how crazy that is for the people. So they are open to these discussions. And when you talk about capitalism with them and the idea that we think you should be able to buy whatever house you want and climb that ladder instead of everybody be stuck at the bottom rung and be equally kind of miserable, they open up to it. They're willing to learn about it. They're willing to kind of go that way. It's just a matter of getting them to that conversation. And that's what the right has been lacking.
No, and it seems also in that discussion, what's lacking is an ability to show these students and, you know, even adults, you know, older adults, when you talk to them about socialism, is the fact that no matter how hard they work, that their efforts won't get them any farther ahead than anyone else. And I think sometimes when students especially, you know, hear that, they're like, wait, what do you mean? You know, kind of hold up there. And I don't think, you know, that a lot of people tell them about that. They don't know that that's part of socialism.
No, you know, socialism is you make it, we take it. And everybody thinks socialism, and instead of thinking the reality of that, which is you could produce all day, but they're going to take whatever it is that you produce to make up for the person who did nothing all day.
Right.
And what that does is it pulls everybody down. That doesn't pull people up, because you inevitably end up with people who just kind of mooch. People aren't perfect. We're going to have the people who rely on everybody else just because they feel like being lazy, not because they have an actual need to. And that's the problem with any kind of big government situation or welfare state situation, is you have these really kind of, and I want to give them a little kind of maybe benefit of the doubt and say they're just really altruistic people.
Right.
But you have those people who would give all day, and they don't understand that that's not necessarily the norm. You have quite a few people who would take advantage of that kind of system and do nothing, or even a government under a socialist regime that would decide that they needed most of the profits and the goods produced, and that the people can kind of get whatever's left over when the government is done with it, when the bureaucracy is done with it. These aren't the little communes where everybody has everything they could ever want in the nice little house that college students and young people tend to think that socialist societies are.
Right. Now, I saw one of your publications. It was called, I believe, Debate Your Teacher and Win. I love that. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Teach people.
Sure. That is how we kind of reach out to students and tell them that there are arguments that you can make to deal with your professors who come from the left. And we actually have another publication coming out relatively soon that will kind of expand on it. But a lot of students get into these situations in the classroom where what you have is an authority figure. And these authority figures may or may not abuse that position. You can't kind of blanket statement it and say that every teacher will do that, because not every teacher will. But you also have students who are afraid to speak out due to fear that the teacher will do just that. During my time in college in Connecticut, I had many conservative students approach me, tell me what their teachers had said in class, and then be too afraid to do anything about it. And I would try to offer them the right steps to go about it. So what How to Debate Your Teacher and Win does is give these students a little bit of a boost. We want to boost their confidence, tell them the right way to frame their arguments, to have a discussion, to move forward, and also give them what they can do if that teacher does abuse their position of authority. That way we can encourage more conversation. Because when you have a classroom that only hears the teacher's opinion, what you don't have is education. You don't have critical thinking. You don't have really expansion of any kind of mind or thought at all. You just have indoctrination. And I hate to use that word because I feel like it gets abused by the media a little bit. But that's what happens when students are afraid to speak up. So what we want to do, especially with that publication, is encourage them to do just that. Speak up, but do so in an informed and respectful manner so you can't get kicked out of class. Your grade can't suffer, and you provide something that maybe inspires the other students to stand up with you.
Well, and I know from my experience, I've got a lot of, I've got a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate in law, and I know throughout my entire, career, if you will, in school, there was never an opportunity for you to really be able to write a paper or voice an opinion that was too far away from what the teacher wanted you to say. If you did, your grades absolutely suffered for it. And I remember, the highest grades that I ever received were the ones where I would listen to the teacher, take verbatim notes, and kind of, sit it back at the teacher. And you're not really learning anything. You're learning one person's opinion. You're not learning, both sides. Even in law school, where you're supposed to debate both sides. We really, when test-taking time came, you'd better be talking what the teacher was saying or your grades were going to suffer for it. And I think it's great that you can teach, students today how to sort of get around that. But I'm wondering, is that really happening? Are they really able to voice their own opinions and be accepted for that today?
I could tell you from my own personal experience that if you're bold enough, you can. I was that student that the political science department kind of dreaded coming into their rooms. I had teachers, I was that student, who would be halfway through a statement, make eye contact with me, choke it back, and change direction. And that was because of the way that I approached them all the time with my argument. It would be in class.
Right.
It was respectful. Right. It was backed up with opinion or facts. And they had to engage in a discussion. And that's kind of what we're trying to teach here with How to Debate Your Teacher. Because what you get a lot of times from the left or professors who do tend to push their opinion are people who don't get challenged because they're in that position of authority. They don't need to worry about being challenged because they're the ones in charge. So when you challenge them and you challenge them in a way that still gives them the respect that they deserve as a professor at an institution, they have really no recourse. And mind you, I used to keep meticulous watch over syllabuses and whatever was expected from me in papers. That way, when I did disagree with them, I could go off of something when I was checking my grade. I put a lot of work into making sure that what I said wasn't getting punished on the basis of ideology. Again, that was in Connecticut. And we have those teachers who encourage debate. My favorite teacher in my entire career of going to school was my high school teacher who taught current events and pre-law, because crazy far left, I mean, tweed jacket with elbow pads, liberal. But we used to have these conversations in class, and it was respectful. Everything was above the belt. He would encourage the rest of the class to chime in. I would call him my favorite crazy lib. He would call me his favorite evil conservative. But we had, it was great. That's what it should be. Other students were exposed to a conversation. You got to hear both sides, and everything was respectful, and we got to walk away laughing and still being friends. I'm still in contact with that teacher occasionally.
Yeah.
That's
what critical thinking is all about, you know. That's what should be taught in school, absolutely, 100%. So
you don't have critical thinking.
No, absolutely, you don't. And Common Core is going to really take care of critical thinking, and there's not going to be any room to think. And, it's one of those things, I'm sure you'll be getting those people coming up the line pretty soon, that it's going to be an even more uphill battle, you know, for your group to try to get to those people who have been sort of taught one way for, 12 years.
Absolutely. And we should be. Right. And we should be worried when the government no longer wants us to be thinking critically. It tells us our elected officials feel too secure in their seats. We've stopped paying attention so that they feel they could take advantage of our young minds and mold them in the direction that they want them to go. And that's a huge problem, especially for a government like ours, where so much is dependent on the people in terms of who gets put into office.
Now, let's talk a little bit, we're talking about students and that end of it and how they're impacted by the teachers. So let's move on a little bit to the Marquette University scenario. Tell us all what happened at Marquette University.
John McAdams is a well-known conservative professor at Marquette. A lot of students would go to him if they had issues regarding other professors, or even if they just wanted to talk politics with the professor and not have it be your usual liberal talking points memo. What happened in a philosophy class is a teacher's assistant, TA, was in charge of the class. She was teaching the class that day, and there was a list of different topics on the board, and what they were doing was applying philosophical thought and philosophical writing to modern political controversies. And gay rights was one of the topics on the board that the TA had actually written down. She chose to write these all on the board, and when she got to that topic, she crossed it off and said, "We don't need to talk about this because everyone agrees on it." A student approached her after class and said very respectfully, "I admire the way the student went about this, because he could have made a stink about it in class, but instead what he did was he approached her after class and said, 'Listen, I have differing viewpoints. I think it would have been beneficial for us to have had a discourse and a conversation.'" And the teachers, or the teacher's assistant's response really was along the lines of, "Well, if you disagree with this, you're homophobic. I won't have homophobic comments in class, and you're more than welcome to drop the class." She encouraged him to drop the class. So the teacher approached John McAdams, who then wrote about it on his blog, which people could find at mu-warriors.blogspot.com. And if it's not there, it is somewhere on my Twitter, which is Conway_Seth, and they could find it. It's pretty easy to see. But he posted this blog. He didn't say anything derogatory about the TA. He never made any kinds of personal attacks or anything like that. But under university guidelines, he's now suspended and banned completely from the university, with his spring classes canceled on the grounds of them investigating him for harassment over posting this story on his blog.
I it's so incredulous. And I know that he's still allowed, though, even though, classes are canceled, he can't go on class, but here we are during the, we'll have to say winter break to be politically correct, during the Christmas break, he can't go back on campus. However, there's nothing to go back on campus for, but I know that he's writing, I guess, a book. And so he's been given permission to come back on campus to write that book, because I'm guessing that it's going to benefit the university for him to finish the book that he's contracted to write, which I thought was, you know, here's another example of, you know, progressives saying, well, we don't want to, you know, we don't like what you're writing, so we're going to shut you down. But if it's going to benefit us, we're going to allow you to, you know, to continue to come on and, you know, write your book, and then we'll decide, you know, what's going to happen to you. And looking at it, you know, what do you think is going to happen to this professor?
I'm not sure as of right now. I know that he is assembling a team of lawyers to combat this.
Good for him.
And I hope, yes, absolutely. I hope that with the support of the Turning Point USA chapter on campus, as well as others who advocate for free speech, especially among people who are in positions like his to be a professor, even if you're speaking in class, you should be able to talk pretty freely about anything so long as you're not infringing on somebody else's rights, because that is, like we talked about before, part of what creates critical thinking. And to allow this professor to be completely fired, lose his tenure and everything else, is to say that you are not allowed to say anything that the university disagrees with. Not even that it reflects poorly on the university, because if you look at his post, it does not. He maintained a professional level. He was very clear on his message and what his problems were with what had happened in the classroom. And the university takes issue with it, I think, mostly because it goes against what the liberal philosophy PA was saying. It doesn't match the message that they want to peddle. It's not right with the agenda. And that's what he's being prosecuted for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's probably one of maybe two, you know, conservative professors at that university, and probably not well-liked, because everybody knows that, you know, he's conservative and, you know, what the school represents and what they want to represent. And also, you know, looking at it from the school standpoint, they don't want to lose people, you know, in the classroom. If you have a lot of students and you have, you know, the liberal parents who are sending their kids there, they don't want to lose those dollars from people who say, oh, my gosh, you know, what's this school like? You know, it's conservative. I can't send my child here. But, you know, you would think, again, in a university setting where you as the consumer, you know, the students and the parents are paying to have your child sent there, that you would welcome an open dialogue. But, again, if the majority of people going there are liberal, you know, you as a parent are probably going to back the school in shutting down that type of, you know, of speech.
You know, the worst part of having to say that most students who go to the universities or to different colleges are liberal is that when you actually talk to them and you get through to them on the issues and you have these discussions, the ideas that they identify with aren't liberal. But they've been told that's cool, that's what they should be, that's the right thing to be, that's the tolerant thing to be, that's the open-minded thing to be, all these buzzwords that sound so nice and rainbows and sunshine and sparkles. That's not what they actually are at all. You have these conversations and they're, yeah, that makes sense, that's so right, I totally agree with you, that's awesome. And then they'll ask you in the same breath, so you support Obama, right? So they don't understand these policies and what they really line up with and what their issue stances are. So sure, they go to these schools and they're, oh yeah, I'm a liberal, and that's just what the other kids are telling them they're supposed to be. It's not what they actually identify themselves as.
Well, and it's also a way to fit in. If you have the same ideologies as everyone else, then you fit in. And a lot of times when it's your first time away from home, you just graduated high school, you still want to fit in. And a lot of times, not everyone, thank goodness, like yourself, you know, a lot of people still do, and they're so concerned that at that point about passing that they're not really concerned with what's being taught, what they're hearing, and does it make sense to them or not. And that's kind of unfortunate. But I'm glad that your group comes in there, like you said, and talks to them. Now, I know that you have another website called BigGovernmentSucks.net. I like that. Very catchy. Can you tell me, I know this is like a 10-week program that you have. Can you run through that a little bit for us?
Sure. Big government sucks was our build up to this last election. We noticed there were 10 weeks from the beginning of the semester to roughly election day, maybe a little bit before, where we could talk about different issues on a week by week basis that would kind of direct students and help them to really figure out what it was that was important to them before they actually went to the voting booth. So we had Student Activism Week and Capitalism Cures Week and National Debt Awareness Week for the first three. That was the first kind of beginning. And all of those things talked about really the economy and the nitty-gritty of it, being active and encouraging students to learn more about capitalism and the national debt and the way that we approach it with all of these weeks, where these very small pieces of paper, maybe 6x5, that had a short paragraph and then some talking points so that it wasn't a policy memo that these students had to try to read while they were walking around, but just a couple quick statements that really told you what was going on. And we got into free speech, and I went to a couple different campuses where I saw free speech zone signs, and they all got a big government sucks sticker because, as far as I'm concerned, anywhere is a free speech zone as long as I'm still within the boundaries of the United States. And
exactly.
Then we had things like, right, and students are so used to free speech zones now that they think that's normal. That shouldn't be normal. Why do we have to tell you where you are and are not allowed to speak?
Right.
And we moved into things like Keep More Stuff Week, where we talked about being taxed and the different kind of tax rates and being allowed to keep more of what you make. And you mentioned earlier in the intro that I grew up in Connecticut and now I live in Texas. And it's such a funny thing for me to look at what I make and doing my work and everything else and compare what the cost of living would be. And in Texas, I'm able to live on my own with just this one job, and I do pretty well for myself. I'm not in poverty. In Connecticut, I would still absolutely need to live at home with my parents and be saving and saving to try to get anything out of what it is
right.
I make because of the cost of living and the taxes up here. And that goes into Keep More Stuff Week. We talked about the NSA with students, which is huge. There is nothing that millennials like more than their privacy. They don't want anybody reading any of their stuff, checking their emails, listening to their cell phone plans. Of all the issues that we went through, whenever I would approach a group of students with the NSA stuff and the privacy stuff, there was always at least one or two students in that group who would turn to their friends who hadn't heard about it and who would immediately jump in and say, oh, my God, man, you haven't heard? They're checking your cell phones. They're checking your emails. And it was this huge thing. They were freaking out.
It's odd, though, on the same, on one hand, like you said, they don't want anybody having any means to get into their, you know, their emails or anything else, and they love their privacy. But on the other hand, this is the same group who's very much for, you know, broadening, you know, transhumanism, broadening, you know, putting things in your arm, you know, where you can watch TV and implant from your arm, you know, future technology. So, which would give, you know, actually give more access. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, what, you know, the technology that's coming, but it's certainly going to broaden, I think, what the government can intercept, and it will cause us to probably lose more of our privacy rights.
Oh, absolutely. And the way a lot of young people really approach that is the without cause part of government going into your stuff. Is right now with the NSA and the information grab and just blindly pulling things, there's no just cause to see what it is I'm emailing, to see who I'm talking to. If I present just cause and I use all those different things, then the government's going to absolutely go into it. But that shouldn't be a fear that I have from my government unless I'm really doing something to give them a reason to need to. And that's where the real issue comes in, is you're almost treating your entire population like criminals, blindly pull all of their data.
And that's funny, too, because, you know, that's the Fourth Amendment rights. And if you were to ask probably some of the college students about their Fourth Amendment rights, I'm wondering how many would know that it's the same thing that they, you know, they're concerned about, but they wouldn't know that. And again, it's, you know, if a talking point of a conservative says to them something about Fourth Amendment, they may close down. But when you talk about it in a different way, then they're more receptive to listening and go, yeah, you're right, I want that. And then you can make the connection that it's the same thing.
Right. You have to pitch it in the way that your average college student who pays absolutely no attention to politics will understand. If you say we need to strengthen your Fourth Amendment rights, the first thing they're going to do is say, yeah, okay, and walk away. Or they'll actually take the time to ask you what that is, which is not as likely to happen. It's just nodding their heads and walking away. But when you talk about the NSA checking their cell phone records, and we had something that said every text you send is a group text, or we had a poster with Obama in Google glasses, and it said, yes, we can read your emails. And that kind of thing really grabbed them because it showed them what was going on with that rather than just giving them a big pile of text and telling them to decipher it. They don't want to do that. The biggest political nerds among us will do that. I'll do that. But your average college student does not want to do that.
Well, it shows you how effective, you know, language is and the pictures that you use. I mean, the picture really has to paint exactly what you're talking about because, you know, in our society today, when everything is done through text and, you know, quickly, give it to me right now, I got to go, everything has to be done. You got to get that message across instantaneously or people are going to move on to something else. So I think, you know, what you're using is absolutely wonderful and really does quickly get the message across, gets the attention, and makes a valid point.
You know, I call my generation the 18 to 29s, the microwave generation. I want it here, I want it now, and I want somebody else to do it for me. So what the left does is they make really crabby images or they use those really awesome buzzwords. I can't count how many times I've been watching the news and I heard the way they spun something and I just sat there in awe thinking that they should give that PR guy a huge raise for coming up with that verbiage for that crazy policy that they just did. How they spun that was spectacular. Even I can applaud them coming from the right. But the right doesn't do that. We don't take advantage of things in that same way. We don't take the same approach to campus. We go onto campus and then we say, well, let's bring a speaker. Let's have a debate. Let's do something really nerdy. Maybe we overthink. That's what happens on the right. Whereas the left will come out with something sensational or celebrity or it'll be really fun and we're going to give you this crazy free thing or we'll pay off your student loans, even though they're paying your student loans with your own tax dollars. And they get your attention and they get it in your face. The right doesn't do that. And that's what we're trying to do is to use social media and these social pic images of celebrities and other things that grab your attention and play the left's game. Do the same thing they've been doing because it is effective, but it's been spreading the wrong message.
Well, and I think, you know, the conservatives are kind of still under the old, you know, the collegiate, you know, stuffy professor that comes in and talks and people listen. And not that that's bad, you know, but it doesn't work today. It may work with the older adults, but it's not working with the age group of 18 to 29 because that's not how they're taught. And the way you're doing it is getting their attention. And I think it's going to be hard, at least harder, to get conservatives to kind of see that you've got to change what you're doing because it isn't as effective. You may like it. It may work well for different age groups, but it's not working well for the younger age group that are being, you know, misled by the progressive left. So, you know, that's great what you're doing, and I'm, you know, committed for that you guys picked up on it and are running with it and really making an impact with that. One of the things, too, you know, speaking about that, you know, I'm just gonna take it to now, like mainstream, what's happening right now out there. I'm gonna just ask you your opinion on a couple of things, and maybe your group's opinion if you know. What has the feeling been on campus with the, you know, the Gardner Brown killings? And I know that school's out now, so the killing of the officers, you know, wouldn't be something that would be talked about on the campus right now. But kind of, what's the feeling about around all of that right now on college campuses, if you're aware of that?
It varies. It sticks pretty much to what you see via party lines. I've had these discussions with different students, not so much in Texas. I've been in Chicago and Connecticut the last few weeks. But you see the stories with students asking for extensions on their finals on the basis of emotional trauma. Which, were you there? No? Okay, come down. But that goes back to coddling our generation.
Yes.
As we've been told all the time, oh, it's okay, sit in the corner and have your feelings and everything will get pushed aside for you. The world will stop for you. And that's not how things work. But different colleges have kind of gone along with it and actually postponed finals. And that doesn't help your students. But
well, and
we also
and
have...
I was going to say it's disappointing also to see that happened in law school, you know, where you're training up lawyers and maybe, you know, you're going to be prosecutors out there. And it's kind of like, oh, gosh, you know, I can't really go into the courtroom and do that today because somewhere, you know, across the United States, I heard something, you know. So that was a little frightening to see that.
How does that make you feel as somebody who's gone through law school?
Not a good feeling at all. It was very disappointing, and that was another indication to me of, like, you know, how serious the problems are and how much work there is to do to change what's been implanted. And I use it that way because, you know, socialism in our public education system has been around since the early 1900s. We're talking a long period of time for it to be entrenched in our young people. And so, you know, to try to turn that around, unless we can do some things like you're doing and kind of do it quickly, it's going to take a really long time because we've made a lot of people into victims who feel that they can't do anything unless somebody else helps them through it, tells them how to do it, or does it for them.
The social progressive movement has done a wonderful job of getting everybody to think that everybody else owes them something. And as my generation grows up and gets out of school and takes on mortgages, they take on jobs, they take on car loans, anything else that comes their way, and they realize that writing a nice letter or saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry, and crying doesn't get them anything, they are in for a shock. We have, I think, a potential generation of failures, and not due to lack of potential, but because we haven't been taught how to succeed. We've just been taught that the world will stop for us and coddle us.
Right, and unfortunately, you know, parents have had a lot of pressure on them as well. I've seen parents with kids in the public school system who have been afraid parents, who have felt that they have to go along with, you know, whatever agenda is going on, put out there in school, and they can't really, you know, tell their child, no, you can't do that. They've got to be there and be the one saying, it's okay, you know, it's okay that you feel that way. You don't have to do it. It's fine. You know, instead of encouraging them and saying, you absolutely can do this. You are smart. You're, you know, a brilliant person. You have a lot of strength and all that. Instead of doing it, they're not. See, the parents are not encouraged to teach their kids that because the schools have told them, no, we need for you to do it this way. We want you to do it this way. And so parents are sort of guilted in the feeling that if they're actually parents, not all people, but some parents feel that, you know, if they try to be parents the way they should be or they want to be, then it's not going to be supported by the schools.
No, everybody is a special little flower, and you just need to encourage their creativity, and everything will just turn out wonderfully. And that's what the school peddles, but that's not exactly how it works. And I grew up in the public school system with a healthy fear of what would happen if I came home with bad grades or got a call from my teacher saying that she wanted a parent-teacher meeting. So I did what I needed to do in school. But what I saw from a lot of my peers, or parents now especially in with the younger children, say kindergarten to fifth grade now, is instead of getting upset with their student, they get upset with the teacher.
Absolutely.
We've got this idea that all of the responsibility falls on the school. All of the responsibility falls on the teachers, the people associated with the school. So these kids go home and they're not told, have you done your homework? Do you have homework questions? How can I help you? You need to make sure you do well on this test. And when the student doesn't do well, the teacher gets a call, and it's, why did he fail? Instead of looking at their child and saying, why didn't you study? Why didn't you ask questions? And I come at this from the place of being somebody who cannot do science for my life. I went through the school system knowing I was probably going to get a C in science, and it was not going to be really pretty, and it would be an ugly struggle. But I would ask the teacher questions. I would go for help. I would do the extra work so that I could bump my grade when I knew I wasn't going to do so hot on a test. And that was, again, because I was told by my parents, better get my butt in gear, even though I wasn't so good at science, I better at least pass that class. And we don't have that as much anymore. It's, well, why didn't the teacher do it? Or why didn't the teacher take care of you? It's, the teacher's not there to take care of you. The teacher is there to give you the tools to learn, to be the person to answer your questions when you bring them to her or him. But if you don't ask those questions, if you don't provide that effort, the teacher can't give that student the help to succeed. But we've lost that kind of personal responsibility in society, and that goes back to the progressivist movement, is nothing's ever your fault. Everything is somebody else's fault. And that doesn't hurt our kids or help our kids. That hurts them.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, you know, parents starting to more and more turn over the reins of everything to the teacher and looking at the teacher as sort of the, you know, the centralized parent, you know, for the kids. And parents have stopped, some parents have stopped making decisions that they need to continue to make. And on the other hand, there are parents who are starting to wake up and realizing, geez, you know, I've kind of lost my kids to the teacher at school and to the school administration. And they're starting to, you know, some people are starting to homeschool, which is absolutely wonderful. I mean, if you do enough of that, then the schools are going to have to change the system because everybody's going to be leaving. The schools are going to be losing money. And unless the government, which they might, you know, continues to take tax dollars to fund the empty classrooms, then somebody's going to have to look at that and say the system's failing.
Right, and we have to look for that change, though, from within the government. If you talk to teachers, there's a lot of frustration among them for exactly the issues that you stated. They want to do better. They want to help the students, but they need the parents to help them to help the students. I've spoken with many a public school teacher, and it's parent-teacher night happens, and the desks are all empty. The parents don't come in. Or you send home letters, and they never get signed, and the teacher or the parent never calls. They never take an active role in helping their student. So people then look at the teacher and say, well, what are you doing wrong? But where is the parent? What does that child go home to? Where, are they eating that night? Do they have a home that night? Are they staying at grandma's because mommy's in jail again? And this is mostly your inner city stuff. But these are real issues that our teachers kind of end up taking the blame for because we've shifted the responsibility off of the parents and onto the government. And that's why we see so many problems in our public schools. And then you have the kids who have great involved parents who want to see their kids do well, but they sit in these classrooms with the kids who aren't pushed to succeed because that push is necessary. Class is really boring. Right. It's really boring, especially when you're young. And if you don't have that healthy fear of mom yelling at you for a bad grade or taking away your Game Boy, turning off TV for a week, then you're not going to push yourself in class. And that takes away from the time that the teacher can give to the students who do have that healthy fear of mom and dad and are willing to learn.
And on the other hand, too, there are a lot of parents who really do care about their kids. And I think, you know, they do need to be mentioned. But because of the economy being so horrible and the lack of jobs, you know, they're out there working sometimes one and two jobs, you know, each. And there's no parent at home really to come to these meetings because they're all working. And just to put food on the table and to survive, you know, this economy that we find ourselves in. So it's really kind of a catch-22. It just keeps going around and around in a cycle that somehow we need to get out of because it's not benefiting the student nor anyone else.
Right. I absolutely agree. And
go ahead.
We need to, I think, to solve that problem, actually look at the root of the problem. And that, again, goes back to kind of big government and too much government and everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Now, another subject that has, you know, come up today, you know, with North Korea. I mean, North Korea didn't want Sony to show the film because they were opposed to it because it talked about their fearless leader. What do you think about that and college, you know, campus buzz about that type of thing?
I wasn't really on campus for when that happened, but I can tell you from social media, and I, working with students, do have a lot of students on all of my social media accounts. Their reaction was kind of that of, why did we listen to them again? What is going on?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're more politically inclined, said we just lost our first cyber war. Because essentially that's
right.
what happened, is we allowed a country like North Korea bully us into not releasing a film. And North Korea spreads propaganda every day about how evil and terrible America is, so why not release that film? It's just, hey, an eye for an eye at this point.
Yeah, and did they, you know, seem to make the connection between that happening and maybe a weak president that we have who it does not instill respect for the United States? That, you know, that could be very much why North Korea felt that they could do what they did.
A lot actually did. In a lot of conversations that I had with various people since that occurred, it was, you know, we have a president now who draws a line in the sand and then wipes it off and draws a line a couple feet down. That way, whoever they're yelling at has a little bit more room to do what it is they want to do. We have a president
mm-hmm.
that doesn't take a firm stance foreign policy-wise, and other countries act up. I tell people foreign policy is akin to dealing with children or toddlers in a sandbox. Everybody wants the same couple toys, and the biggest kid is going to take the toy unless there's somebody navigating and saying everybody needs to play nice. And when we stop with having that one person saying you guys need to knock it off and we need to play nice or else you go in timeout or you have to go home, whatever it may be, then everybody acts up. And that's what we're seeing right now, is everyone is acting up because there's no authority figure. And
right.
we've lost that, President Obama.
Right, absolutely. And I did notice late today they said that, you know, when the Internet went down in North Korea, they were out pretty much, I guess, all day. They are now saying that was Anonymous who did that, who hacked into their system and caused their Internet to go down. What do you think about that?
I would be very surprised to hear that was us. I would be more inclined to believe it was the group Anonymous or something like that, where people just kind
right.
of got fed up and took it down. But then I think North Korea's internet, what websites does that really go to? Because you know that they're not allowed to freely go onto social media or anything like that. What are these people really seeing anyway?
Yeah.
So,
and how difficult was it to take it down?
Right. The 10 websites that they're allowed to go to.
Right.
It's horrible to say, and you know, these are people who are definitely suffering under a very
right.
tyrannical regime. But at the same
Absolutely.
Time, it's, well, how do you really approach this?
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult situation, but I'm with you. You know, you don't allow a country like North Korea or anybody else to dictate to the United States what they can and can't do. And you know, under this president, what we have seen is time and time again, you know, his apology tour, his sort of bowing down to the other countries, and it's starting to take its toll. Like in the past under Ronald Reagan, you know, I can't see this ever happening with North Korea. I mean, there's just no way that they would have done that. They know who they're dealing with, and they know that they can have a lot of leeway to do a lot of things. So not a good thing to see, not a very comforting thing to see at all. Now, your group, can you tell me a little bit down the road as we kind of wrap up here, what are your goals? What are things that you're going to be working on? Tell me a little bit about what's happening.
We are looking to hire even more field coordinators. We're presently in 5 or 6 states right now with full-time staff, and we really want to expand that so we could have a much larger impact. We're going to have some part-time student field coordinators so that our message is still on campus even when we can't be. We're just one person. I could only do 1, maybe 2 campuses a day. But if we have
right.
part-time staff and students who go to those campuses, what we're doing is we're giving students a chance to make money and spread our message. So we're trying to do that.
Wow.
We're reaching
Capitalism.
Into different markets. Yes, exactly. That's what we stress to our students is, look at this, you're going to school, you have a job.
Wow.
But we're really trying to expand our reach. We want more of a media presence. We want to speak at different places. We are going to be at CPAC in a big way this year to try to reach more students. So it's really about expanding. We've seen a lot of success with what we have. So we're going
mm-hmm.
to move into our next message and keep pushing the idea that big government sucks and that capitalism and the free market are really the way to go.
And what candidate would you see that you may be backing if they ran for president in 2016?
Well, separate from Turning Point, because Turning Point
right.
doesn't endorse candidates, personally, I'm a little bit of a Rand Paul. I'd be good with a Ted Cruz, too. But I like the idea that Rand can pick up more young people. Because even if they aren't staunch conservatives, economically, Rand would appeal to them. Rand goes into the minority communities and things like that. The way that I look at our 2016 fight is we need to get a Republican in. We need to get somebody who's not a rhino. And we can't put a Chris Christie in 2016 because what would even be the point of that? Why did we bother? I would like to see us start making that move in the right direction. Oh, God. He announced his candidacy formally while a bunch of us were together, and the eye roll at the table is, what are you doing? But that's what the establishment does. Bush could be the best candidate in the world, but based on his name alone, he'll never win a national election. Not right now. The Bush name is still too poorly received by too many people for it to win a national election. But that's what the establishment does, is they pick who's next in line. And it's Jeb Bush's turn, so let's run him. And that's why they lose elections. Somebody like Cruz or like Paul could excite a lot of people. They'll excite your blue collar. They'll excite your far right. They'll excite your young people, your independent, your libertarian. That's how you win a national election. And that's what we need to focus on.
Absolutely. And without maybe calling them conservative values, you know, to the youth out there, just, you know, getting it across that that's what it is, but without having to say that, because I think that sometimes is a turnoff when you even use that word for people in the 18 to 29-year-old group.
Right. They don't like to hear conservative because they're told that's the party of the racist old white men who are warmongers and hate mongers and bigoted and whatever other buzzword the left wants to put at them. But when
and
you talk about the issue, you get to see the binders full of women. Yes.
Right.
It's what they fall for.
Right. So, I mean, it is a lot, you know, in the language that you use, from what I'm hearing with the age group that you're pinpointing. I mean, it really does matter. And it also does matter about, you know, getting the images out there that will make a quick but lasting impression. And then letting these people see sort of firsthand what the benefits are for following a different path, you know, capitalism versus socialism. So it's, you know, really good point. And Stephanie, we've got about 2 minutes left. Anything you would like to say that we haven't talked about really quickly as we wrap up?
Check out our website. Check out turningpointusa.net. There's lots of ways you could either click on to get involved. If you're a college student, if you're listening, if you're a parent and you're listening, direct your students there. Check out what we have for students. We have a columnist program, which is really great because we don't give them timelines or tell them what to write about. It's just when you can write, we encourage you to write, and it's stuff that you could put on a resume because it gets published. If you're listening and you want to support us, that link is on our website as well. We always appreciate any support as we are a nonprofit.
Wonderful. Well, I thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I wish you all the success in the world. It sounds like you guys are doing one heck of a job, and I hope that you keep in touch and let us know upcoming what's happening, and perhaps we can have you or somebody else back on that can tell us details of what you're doing and how we can help you.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me on. I love to talk about Turning Point and the great things that all the people who work with us are doing.
Well, we love having you on, and thanks so much. Have a Merry Christmas.
You as well. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, and we'll talk to you really soon. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Well, you heard it there. We know what we have to do. We know how we can help. We know how that we have to approach people in that age group a bit differently than what we've done, and we can give groups like Stephanie's TurningPointUSA.net a lot of help with our time, with our money, and help them do what they need to do in order for us to succeed as conservatives. I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Wish everybody a Merry Christmas, And we will be back next week on the 29th, and we're going to be at it again. We have a true fight ahead of us and continuing. So everyone, take care out there. See you next week. Until then, God bless and be safe.